The reason why we exist is because we make people feel good. We are a brand that's centered around health and humanity, and nothing is going to change that. And I think ultimately, and you talked upon it earlier in this call, that people are spending so much time connected on their devices and they're having a lot of connectivity, but they're not having a lot of human connection. And the pandemic has accelerated that. But pre the pandemic, people were already lonely. They were isolated. They're having these virtual relationships. They were missing that team camaraderie. They were missing that connection. And ultimately, that's Bluestone Lane's purpose.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. Nicholas Stone is the founder and CEO of Bluestone Lane. If you haven't heard of Bluestone Lane, you will soon. Bluestone is the fastest growing premium cafe brand in the United States, with over 50 locations across 9 markets. Headquartered in New York City, Bluestone Lane is influenced by Australian independent coffee culture and is committed to providing elevated cafe experiences focused on human connection, something Nick saw that was lacking when he moved to New York City. So he did something about it. There is a lot more to Nick's story than the incredible chain he is building. Nick's story details spending time in the corporate finance industry and prior to that as a professional athlete in the AFL. Upon sitting down with Nick, I couldn't help but inquire into his professional sports career and how it ultimately shaped his path forward.
It's a complicated game, very frenetic, doesn't stop, and it has these multiple attributes of physicality and coordination. So it's a bit of a hybrid, I'd say, between soccer, rugby, and basketball, but nothing that closely resembles either of those three sports. So it's truly unique, an indigenous game played only in Australia. It is the indigenous football code, the most popular football code. So I played it all my junior years. And I loved it. My uncle played professionally, my grandfather. So I had a bit of lineage there and was drafted in my last year of high school. The AFL national draft primarily selects players that are 17 or 18, and I was picked up and hadn't finished my year 12, my final year of school, and started, and I ensured that I kept studying. I wasn't going to, unfortunately, it's not paid like an NBA or a baseball contract where you one deal and you're done.
So, yeah, that might have been a different story, putting a lot more time into that.
You wouldn't be speaking to me right now, I'd imagine. I might be, hanging out in some island. But I played for 6 seasons, 3 teams. I was a bit of a journeyman, 2 years at each, trying to find my spot and rhythm, but it petered out and I was only 23. So it's amazing to think that a lot of the college kids are graduating then going pro at 23, where I was sort of, my career had already finished for that 6 years, but learned so much in such a compressed time period. You're 17, you're living at home, and suddenly you're playing professionally, competing against your heroes, and just the demands physically. Because Australian rules football requires a huge element of running. It doesn't stop. And just training at that level was a big step up, but it's held me in such great stead for the next 2 careers I've had. And hopefully I draw upon those lessons in the teams that I run and how I execute my role as part of that team.
Is there anything you really took away from your years of playing Australian rules football that has been kind of a guiding principle for you through your banking career and now with Bluestone Lane?
I think you learn so much about 2 things: innovation, like your own personal innovation, which has a very close alignment to resilience. Because what I found with my AFL career is nothing was perfect. I wasn't, even though I was a star, sort of a strong player growing up, when you get in the AFL, you're just average. You're just mediocre. You're no longer the star. And I think that it's so hard to, and it's so tight, the difference between the absolute best and the 50th player is these small, tiny increments. And so constantly you're working on your game, innovating, you're finding ways that you can train differently or position yourself and work on. So I think it's that constant mentality around continuous improvement. And then combined with that was the resilience, that nothing's perfect. No matter anyone you look at or any business or anyone that materially looks like they've got it all worked out, below the water, they're like a duck. They're treading. They're trying to work it out themselves. Often a lot of the most successful in potentially superficial ways are the most lonely. And what I discovered was during that period was about, even though I didn't achieve my goals and I probably had my whole career doubting myself, I was determined not to let that be the mark that acted as this precedent for the rest of my life. I was going to use it as a learning experience and I was going to take the great things and the development opportunities and catapult them into my next couple of careers. So I think more than anything, it's those two themes. And then, but you know, teamwork would also be a massive one. Like being a part of a high performance team where you're dealing with like people who have been selected because of these attributes, like that's an inspiring, addictive thing to be a part of, to be part of a team that's like doing really, really well. It doesn't matter. It didn't matter to me to be the best player in the team. It was just to be part of it. And that has been, that's what I'm attracted to. So if I was in other careers post-football that didn't resemble those attributes or didn't have that attitude, like we're going to continue to improve and we're going to be really, really competitive and we're going to achieve a lot, I don't think I could be at my best. And ultimately, I don't think I would stay. I think I would find another group to aggregate with because I love that thrill of doing things that others haven't or constantly learning and improving.
Yeah, I love what you said about looking at others and you know, you're on this show and a lot of the people we have on this show have been extremely successful like you have within many areas of your life. And you talk about, you don't know what's really going on underneath and with many people. And I love your honesty and being authentic that it's not all, hey, I'm the CEO or founder of Bluestone Lane. And that it sounds like you learn that playing football and playing team sports, that no matter who you are, no matter where you are at the top, that there's adversity in everyone's lives.
Yeah, and there's fragility. We're talking about, let's talk about the greatest golfer, arguably the greatest golfer of all time, Tiger Woods. You know, he's in hospital right now, may never play golf again. And he's had his ups and downs, and it's a tough, tough road. Tom Brady, arguably the best NFL player of all time, he had to deal with the adversity of changing teams and moving his family and then he's gone, climbed to the pinnacle again. Like nothing's perfect. No one has the perfect life.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of externalities to fame and success and wealth, and there's a lot of complexity. And I think that the more energy you spend, I find if I spend energy comparing or wishing I had something, it's just a complete distraction. It's not going to do you any good. And you got to redirect it.
It's wasted. I call it compare and despair because especially myself, I get to interview these mega successful people on this show. And I'm an entrepreneur. I've started some businesses, but and had done well and sold them. But like, you know, I'm talking to people like yourself, people have built incredible businesses.
You don't have to put me in that. I'm not there yet.
You will be. If you do it though, and you get to that point that you're comparing yourself and understanding. And I love what you said about Tiger Woods and the fragility, because so many people who become entrepreneurs, so many people, it's just about, they think success is the money. They think success is, you know, having themselves on a billboard. And at the end of the day, what I've learned from doing this show and talking to people like yourself is that success is, that the business is just one part of it. And like you said with Tiger, it's like, it kind of equals the playing field. Like you could be sitting in a hospital right now after all this success, right? And I say it because there's so many entrepreneurs out there who are struggling with their businesses to get it going. And myself, you know, included with starting a new business. And you have to really just, I think, just appreciate your life in so many areas, not just in the business area. And it sounds like you really learned that at a young age and a lot through playing football.
Yeah, being part of teams. Sport is such a wonderful thing to be a part of because it democratizes people's backgrounds, education, income level, where they went to school, the opportunities their parents afforded them. You got to play You got to wear the same uniform. You got to play by the same set of uniform rules. And it's looking for other attributes. And I just think it's such an important part of growing up. It teaches you so much about yourself and the role and how you can play a role in society, not just the team, and being more open-minded and accepting of people of different backgrounds. And I think that that's such a big part of the Australian culture, team sports. And one thing that I think is quite strange is, like, in America, a lot of people play team sports up until their final years of high school. And if they're not incredible and they're not on the varsity team, it's basically like they're left to the doldrums. They give up. You know, it's not worth pursuing anymore because yep. they can't be the best. And then certain players then go and play in college. And then if they don't get pro, that's it. In Australia, they have thousands of these amateur leagues where it doesn't matter your ability. You can play in the top team, you can play in the fifth grade team, but they keep them going for this team orientation, the socialization of playing and the ritual of going to training and all of those elements that are so important in just, I think, being more rounded as a person. And it certainly has been a huge part of my life and something that I really missed when I moved to New York. And I joined a couple of basketball teams. I never played basketball in my life, even though I'm tall. But, you know,
you're probably better than half the people anyway. I play in those leagues.
Trust me, I'm absolutely not. I'm good at rebounding. That's about it. But, you know, I think that it's just a really, I've always found it such a rewarding thing. And it's certainly made me a better leader and a better contributor to a team in different fields now in business. So, yeah, you know, it had a huge impression. And when you're that young, you're very malleable. You're still learning your way and you're crafting your way, but you're forced to grow up very quickly. And I was very lucky that even though my career didn't eventuate to all the as big as I hoped it to be, and I look back on it now and it was serendipitous that I probably didn't stay in the system for 10 years because I then wouldn't have been able to move to achieving banking and then move to New York and then meet my wife and then start Bluestone. So you can never anticipate. You've just got to constantly give your best, act with integrity, and keep improving. And ultimately, like, that's what I love in life. I love trying to improve and trying meeting new people and trying new things. And Bluestone Lane's a case in point. I'd never worked a day in hospitality in my life and then decided to build the, you know, the largest premium cafe chain in New York, right? And you know, we've been successful in doing it. So, but Jesus, it's been tough. And those lessons of resilience, you get them in space as being an entrepreneur. It's certainly not as glamorous or cracked up as a lot of people prayed it to be. You got to have that. You got to be galvanized, and you have to be. You have to realize that nothing's going to go perfectly. No matter if you've raised all the great, you got all the great investors, all the great money, you got all the go to market. It's still going to be brutally tough, and you've got to steel yourself for that and try and build a great team that can help you achieve your goals.
Yeah, what I've learned from being an entrepreneur, from hosting this show, from the one thing I always come away with is what you just said, where things are never going to go perfectly. The people I find who are the people all have the same attribute that they have. The willpower, they're persistent, they pick themselves off the mat. When something doesn't go right, they figure out why and they work on it, but they don't give up. And I really think in terms of, if I was to say the number one character trait of the most successful people and the people I've had on this show, it's without a doubt understanding that it's not going to be perfect, nothing's going to go perfect. And it's the ability to understand and pick yourself up and do it. And that's why I love doing this show. And that's why I love how you started, because so many people might look at you or look at the other guests and be like, oh, it's probably easy street just from the start. And it's never the case. So I do want to go back. So you finish playing, and do you immediately move to New York? Like, how does the finance, or were you in Australia working in finance?
Yeah. So this is, and your point's right. Like, on superficially, so many people, as back to the same point, look like they've got it worked out. But for me, I was already fired three times by the age of 23. Like, main job, professional job and you were fired? Like walking into a room with the coaches saying, we're no longer renewing your contract, good luck, and trying to find another club. That happened 3 times. And then I had to transition into a new career. And luckily, while I was playing, I never gave up my university studies. And I was very fortunate my parents kept me very level-headed and could see the longer-term need. And I had also conditioned myself that, hey, even if I have a great football career and I'm done at 30, what am I going to do and where am I going to find this utility for the next, hopefully, 50, 60 years? I'm not going to ride off the back of my coattails when I was 28 playing in front of 100,000. Like, it's only going to carry you so far. You need actual real intrinsic reward. So I studied. I was so interested in working overseas. I was always interested in companies and financial markets. And I just love the idea of how companies build brand and they diversified products. And so I studied business, and fortunately I had just finished my university. Effectively, I had my last exam and then I got cut from my third team like 4 days later, and I found my way into an internship. I don't know what I was being paid, nothing basically.
Yeah, probably.
By the hour, nothing, just to get some experience. And from there, I just said, listen, I'll take any job. And I remained on, and then I applied for some graduate programs, and I was lucky to land one. And I landed one that enabled me to start early, and it also enabled me to stay in Melbourne, where I'm from. And, you know, I was just fortunate. I got that break, but I didn't land the graduate role because I played AFL football. I landed the graduate role because I had the prerequisites, because I kept studying while I was playing football. And I think I had learned so much about dealing with a professional environment that I was quite mature in my approach for someone who's 23, 24. And from there, I used all those experiences to pave my way. I started there in 2006, and I found my way to New York in 2010. So it worked out well.
Yeah, I want to talk about New York and coming to New York, but it's so striking. You remind me, we had this guy on the podcast, Tim Brown from Allbirds.
Yeah.
And I know you're from the same side of the world, you know, side of the world.
We've connected before. He's incredible.
And the story just about him too, going through the sports stuff, the rejection, how the thinking about innovation and interest in certain things, and how he's taken that into his career now. And now he's living in the States, and it's very striking. I don't want to just say, cause you're from Australia and he's from New Zealand, but the sports background and everything and your focus, it really reminds me of his story.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors.
If there's one thing my new business has taught me, it's that digital media is exponentiating by the minute. In podcasting, our favorite medium to promote content, as many of you have seen with How Success Happens, is video clips. However, many of you may be wondering, how do I create all those great videos? Well, I'd like to introduce you to Vidyard, an easy-to-use yet powerful video solution that makes it simple to create videos, post them ad-free, share them with others, and track their performance. Vidyard's applications are truly limitless. You can upload or create videos and embed them into email campaigns, landing pages, and blog posts to generate and engage more sales-ready leads. You can use interactive video elements and video personalization to boost viewer engagement, accelerate the buyer journey, and convert viewers into pipeline. Vidyard is built for business with robust analytics, integrations with top enterprise tools, and customization options that answer businesses' unique needs. It measures how each video impacts revenue and how they perform across your website, email marketing, prospecting campaigns, and more, all from one central dashboard. Sign up for Vidyard free today by going to vidyard.com/HSH. And just like you guys, the team at Vidyard can't keep up with all these promo codes on podcasts, so they're making signing up really easy, super easy. So no promo code needed. Just go to vidyard.com/HSH to start using Vidyard completely free. And as a bonus, get their 2021 B2B Video Trends Guide.
And our next sponsor.
As many of you know, a large and rewarding part of being an entrepreneur is getting to go around pitching clients, not only locally and domestically, but even abroad. However, in the unfortunate chance that you need to make an emergency visit to the hospital to seek medical attention, your health insurance may not cover the full cost of an emergency medical flight to a hospital or trauma center. It's definitely something I've thought about as I do a lot of travel. Even if you have a comprehensive coverage, you could still get hit with substantial deductibles and copays. There is a solution to this problem, however, with Air Medcare, a membership that protects you and your loved ones from all out-of-pocket expenses for medical air transport when flown by an AMCN provider. Best of all, it's affordable. Membership covers your entire household for as little as $85 a year. Literally, that's just pennies a day. In this podcast, we discuss how successful people prepare to face and overcome challenges. An Air Medcare Network membership can help you plan for the unexpected so you can take on your day as an entrepreneur anywhere you go without the fear of transportation costs in the event of an emergency. As a bonus, How Success Happens listeners get up to a $50 e-gift card when they join today. Visit airmedcarenetwork.com/success and use offer code SUCCESS.
And we're back.
2010 comes. Do you get an offer for a job in New York? And like, what's your take? Were you like, you said you would like to go overseas, but like, where were you at that point in your life?
I was in Melbourne. I'd worked a little bit in Sydney, but then I got the graduate job and I could stay in Melbourne. And I was obsessed about this need to go and work in either New York or London. And it was always New York number one because I'm big into rock and roll music, and so many of my favorite bands coming out at that time were from New York. The Strokes were big, the Nashville were big, the Yeah Yeahs, they're all landing in one spot, Interpol. And I'm big into rock and roll and indie. And it's just the epicenter of fashion, of commerce, of sports, music. I just needed to be there. And I traveled there when my footy finished and I just had the best holiday. It was just, you know, like all the classic stories, like trying to get into a New York nightclub and going to, you know, I went to Soho House as a guest of my dad's friend. And I'm like, just all those things that I was literally just caught in the bright lights, and I was addicted to it. I was like, I've got to get back here. I've got to find anyway. And yeah, it was the best city in the world, hands down. You know, that's why at Bluestone, we're like doubling down in New York because COVID's been terrible, but the fastest place to rebound is going to be New York City. I'm telling you right now.
I agree with you 100%. As I have a Bluestone actually on my corner. I'm a lifelong New Yorker. I want you to tell my kids what you think about New York, because they're like, I want to grow up in the suburbs. And I'm like, I'm never leaving because I grew up in the suburbs. But I really believe I love the fact you're doubling down on New York, because just with everything that happened with the outdoor dining, and even you guys during the pandemic set up this little outdoor space at that location on 73rd, and people were just having their morning coffee there, and they're going to keep that now, which is great. I've heard at least the one thing our mayor has done right in all his years is I think this, having the restaurants in places like Bluestone have this outdoor seating, which I think is going to bring things back. So I'm so glad to hear that you're doubling down and increasing your presence. Tell me just though, when you got to New York in 2010 and worked in finance, what was that like? And then eventually, how come you decided to become an entrepreneur?
So on the journey, I actually was trying to get to New York in 2009. And because of the financial crisis, I had an interview in New York and in London. I got home and I'd started going out with my wife as a girlfriend a year and a half earlier. And I got home and they said, yeah, you interviewed really well, but there's no positions in corporate finance or investment banking. We're like bringing everyone home, financial crisis, like it's game over. And then sure enough, she's studying at university, but she's modeling sort of part-time as a part-time job. And she, when I was over, she came along and she met with a couple of agencies just for no like prescriptive reason, just casual, She gets signed by Ford Model Agency. So she has to go across. She gets a 3-year contract and a visa. I'm the one I was interviewing. I can't get a job. I'm like, well, this is just great. My dream girl is going to go model in New York. I can't, I'm the, you know, the plus one in Melbourne, the loser. Okay. So I ended up looking like, how do I get there? And I ended up studying. I'd done a master's degree and I had been studying my MBA and I was able to get into Fordham Business School and do an executive program there. And that acted as a catalyst because by the time I was about to, the bank I worked for, said, hey, actually, we're actually, the financial crisis hasn't hit Australia. We have all this money flowing in from the best counterparties in the world, Apple and corporates, because they can't give it to Citibank. They can't give it to Lehman. They've got to give it to us. Well, why don't you go and build a business? And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, you've got 9 months to prove that you can build a business in New York and London. And that's what happened in 2011. But in 2010, I had the opportunity for the first 5 months in New York City as a full-time student that wasn't entirely broke. So I was, it was the best time of my life. I could go out every night. I could watch this band. I could see that band. I had good mates who were in a band at the time that were huge called The Temper Trap. And, you know, they played like five nights. They played, you know, Terminal 5, Music Hall of Williams, four nights in a row. I was able to tour around with them. I went to Lollapalooza. It was just beautiful, right? And then I started work and I just had the best time. And I loved working in banking in New York as well. The city was just intoxicating and the friends I met, and we were really lucky that we took this tiny, tiny apartment in West Village and cost a fortune. And it was like 300 square feet and I ended up having bed bugs we got from the neighbor. But, you know, it was like, it was the best. It was the best. It was just never hesitate in doing it all again. And really lucky, I think we landed in the right part and we built this community. I love West Village. It felt
I used to live down there and West 4th and 6th for years. And it's just such an incredible, it's so different than any other neighborhood or place within New York City. Yeah. And just the vibe and the feel. And I called it moving to the suburbs, the Upper West Side, because, you know, I come home at night and like on my doorstep, there'd be like, you know, just passed out, drunk people and homeless and like motorcycle. And like, I mean, I was right on West 4th and 6th, but there's parts in the West Village. I mean, it's just unlike anywhere else in the world, which I love that area. So you guys, you were down there, you're working in finance. So how did the whole Bluestone Lane come about?
So I'm working in banking and I just realized how much I missed this Australian coffee culture. Because in Australia, we don't have, it's the 13th biggest economy in the world. Small population, only 25 million, but big cities. Melbourne and Sydney both are 4 million plus people, right? And there's this huge part of this coffee culture and it's independently led. And it happened in the 40s when we had mass migration pre and post World War II. The Italians and the Greeks, they brought their espresso machines. So we went from drinking tea, British colonial commonwealth, to coffee. So we'd started espresso. We still don't have any drip, but the espresso started in the 40s. If you look back at the US, like the espresso started in the late 80s when Starbucks arrived with Schultz after his trip to Italy. But there's no Starbucks, there's no Peet's, there's no Dunkin', there's no Tim Hortons, there's no Costa Coffee, there's no Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf. It's all independent operators. And why the independents are so interesting, just like why do you like going to independent restaurant? Because it makes you feel like a local and they know your name, they know your face, they know your order, they know what time you're going to come in, they know your kids' names, they know your dog's name, and you often know a lot about them. It's reciprocal. So when I came to New York and we're working huge hours, there's no mistake. You come to New York, you play hard, but you work hard, right? Everyone wants to live in New York, so you better shape up or you're going to have to ship out. And we were working big, big hours in banking. And in Australia, we would have these twice a day. We'd go in the morning as a team, have the social chat, the banter, down the elevator to our local, walk in, Jimmy the barista knows your name, makes you feel like a rock star, you have that recognition. And then we'd have it again in the afternoon because we could finish work at 6 or 10 or 3 in the morning. Yeah. And that's what we did to like recharge. And I started working in the office and I'm on 47th and Park in JP Morgan building, 277 Park Avenue. I'm talking to my colleagues, I'm like, let's get a coffee. And they're like, I go, where's your local? And then, we just go to that Starbucks. But you can't have a local. And they're like, no, we just go and get a coffee. And I was like, this. And so after a while, I just sort of started looking at it. And I became kind of obsessed with the industry. And one thing that was really, was quite transformational for me was Starbucks. So in Australia, there's a very myopic view on Starbucks. It's terrible coffee and they're too chainy and they're like McDonald's. But what I came to appreciate very quickly is how successful they are and how the catalyst they've been to educating people about espresso coffee and the third place. And anyway, I've moved here and I started to look up Starbucks market cap. Well, it was $90 billion market cap. And now this is pre like the real big tech bubble we're in right now. But back in 2011, $90 billion US, I just couldn't believe it. And I'm like, okay, so like who are the competitors? The second biggest competitor was Dunkin', and it was worth about $6 billion. So I'm like, how have they done this? And there must, and then I was kept thinking to myself, there must be an alternative. There has to be something that is more focused on this individual independent spirit where you have that recognition, you feel like a local, that has better quality product, better quality service, better quality sort of aesthetics, environment, and makes you feel like a local, not a customer, not someone who is looking to be dispensed just caffeine. And that really was the purpose. It was more about human connection and the social ritual than really coffee. I had no background and I like nice tasting coffee, but I wasn't sort of this coffee head that was addicted. I'd never made coffee. I'd never made coffee at home, but I loved the socialization and what it stood for as part of my daily ritual. It made me a better person. It gave me an escape and it gave me that recognition. And the other thing that gave me even more conviction is West Village, a great example. I'm living in West Village and there's two wash and fold places on every street in West Village, right?
Yes, true.
And people are very patriotic and defensive about their wash and fold. So you might say, hey, Rob, I go to Jimmy here. And you know, no, I go to Sally here. And I'll say, well, why don't you try Jimmy? No, I go to Sally. Sally's, that's my relationship. I trust them with my gear, my underwear, my socks, my shirts. I don't mix and match my wash and fold. And people had this really strong local relationship. And they had it also with the mani and pedi, where they got mani and pedi. So they had it with the hairdresser, they had it with their bar, but they didn't have it with their coffee shop. I keep thinking to myself, this is the opposite in Australia. Like the number one like local business that you're going to be attached to is your coffee shop. Where in New York, I'm not saying it wasn't important, but it wasn't particularly important because I think the commercial success of Starbucks was more about convenience and speed. So I thought that all these elements combined, there must be an opportunity to build something. And sure enough, two blocks away from the office at 277 Park, next to Smith & Walensky, there's an office building. It's 805 Third. It's a Class B office building.
Yep.
It's not Class A.
I've seen it.
Yeah. Down a subterranean basement under an escalator, there was a 200 square foot spot and we decided to open the first Bluestone Lane there. And that was in mid-2013.
So how did that...
It's a wild ride.
First off, I love it and I look at it, you know, us here in the States and drinking coffee. I mean, it used to be I go to the bodega, get a cup of coffee. And then I think why Starbucks did so well originally was, yes, convenience and that. But it was also, we weren't used to the experience you had in Australia. So for us going in and seeing someone like a barista, like making a nice coffee, you'd pay $4 instead of the 99 cents from the guy in the cart or whatever. But I do think for what you've done now and having that local, like people need that community and connection. And I think, you know your people in the Starbucks, but like I could see why you guys have probably done so well in that respect because you are selling the experience and you are selling kind of that look. Like I love that idea of your local hangout, your local bar, your local wash and fold, whatever it might be. And people want that. And I think that's a reason I could see for the success. And so you start with this one concept idea. Like, are you putting in all the time? Is it just you? Like how does it start?
So we raised $350,000. I put in half and then the guy I sat next to put in 50 grand. My boss in Australia put in 50 grand and two Aussie mates. They put in 100 grand. And we opened that store, and then we quickly followed it up with a store at 30 Broad Street. So next to the Stock Exchange, used to have part of the Stock Exchange on a couple of their floors there, pre the digitization of the exchange. And it was an 85-year-old building, never had a retail amenity in the lobby, and we built one there. And I'm still working full-time in banking. So I'm not, at this stage, I really didn't even have ambitions of ever leaving banking. I was like, oh, I'm loving banking and I'm making money and I love Bluestone, but I don't think it'll ever be big enough for me to move across. And, I like going. But I think store number three acted as this catalyst where everything kind of changed. So our third store was actually not a coffee shop. It was a cafe. And cafe being more like a restaurant, a daytime restaurant. And we opened it in West Village because that was where I lived. And I just thought that there's community of people we know here that will support it. It's also kind of on the Australian tourist track. And in 2018 and 2019, more than 1 million Aussies visit the US. That's 5% of the population visited the US in that year. So, like, they like traveling, they like spending, and they like supporting their Aussie cafe. So I thought, listen, worst case scenario, the Aussies will at least come and, it'll keep the lights on somewhat. But we took this former barbershop on the corner of Perry Street and Greenwich Avenue. Yeah. And we called the store Collective Cafe. And it was acknowledging the support we'd got from all of our friends. It was a collective effort. And it was a homage to that. And sure enough, we opened it in the summer, early summer of 2014, and it exploded. It was too busy for us to manage. And we didn't have air conditioning. We didn't have any money. Like, we were just scraping to put it together, but it exploded. And there was a couple of things that really worked out advantageously. The first thing is Taylor Swift came in within the first sort of couple of weeks, and she came in twice. And the second time she came in, the paps were everywhere taking photos of. Now, I'm not for that. I don't like it at all. I want people to be able to live the lives they want and not be harassed. But there's no doubt when she came in the second time and was photographed outside the cafe that it helped drive awareness. Because at this point, we're just working off word of mouth. The second thing that really helped was we were next to probably the number one spray tan place in New York. So guess who kept walking in? All the Victoria's Secret models, all these actors. they'll get a spray tan next door and then they'll come for coffee afterwards. So you name them, they were there, the Hadids and all the big names. So you just started to get this buzz, like this organic buzz, and cool music. And a feminine type of color palette. We weren't the Brooklyn black, very, very wood and just masculine. We were and more feminine. We had seafoam green and turquoise, more tranquil colors. And it just started to gain more and more momentum. And, we turned that store, which was completely disheveled, looked nothing like the way it does now. And, we developed just incredible community where we would end up seeing the majority of our locals daily. And one of the really interesting indications for its success and its focus on being this social ritual, this daytime sort of catalyst to bring people together, was 90% of transactions were two or more people. So it was really, Rob, you going with a mate or your partner or your kids or whatever and catching up for a coffee or a juice or an avocado toast or what have you. And I just knew then that it's really working. It was busy, but it was not just people coming in sitting on their laptops. We haven't been part of that big laptop movement. It was people coming together and talking and catching up. And instead of having a dinner that might be an hour and 15 to 2 hours and 15, they were catching up for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, not really longer than 45 an hour. And it was on the way to work, or it was after work, or it was on the way to the gym, or it was on the way to school, or it was with your newborn. And, it just felt really great. And from there, we started to scale.
So when was it when you was it after that store, that location, that all of a sudden you're like, well, maybe I should walk away from my finance job? And when was that final moment when you were like, I'm all in?
So I was still hedging my bets, per se. And like, I'm a bit of a different thinker as it relates to entrepreneurial ventures. Like some people, they claim like you got to go all in or, you know, early, and then you fail fast, fail early. I think I'm cut from a different jib. I'm more like, hedge your bets until you've got enough indications and you've done analysis that it's worth jumping into, because you're going to blow up the cost structure. As soon as you come in, they've got to pay you, and you've probably got a, you might have a family, you might have a rent, you might have a mortgage, you've got to feed yourself, you've got to pay health insurance. Like, you know, you have certain things that are required to survive. And then the thing is like, fail fast, fail early. I reckon that's crazy. I reckon you want to stay in the game and iterate as long as you can. Like, I don't think it's good to fail fast, fail. Like, so you can buy yourself enough time to keep iterating. And if you iterate to the point, let it go. But it's a very bull market, Silicon Valley rate. I don't think it applies to all industries, and I definitely don't think it applies to more consumer and retail. I think it's staying in the game and constantly rating and working on your value proposition. So I ended up leaving bank in 2016, had 12 locations. It got to unsustainable. I either need to let go, bringing someone in, or full time. And why don't I take sabbatical from banking? See how it goes. Fair enough. I didn't go back.
You know, so how inflection point. In terms of the growth, and you saw it working, what were the next steps in terms? Did you say we need to raise capital if we really want to grow this business? And what year was that? Because I think today you have over like 50 locations, maybe probably even more. But what was it at that point? Was it like, hey, this is the plan. We can really make this work nationally, internationally, and we need to go raise money?
Well, we did a SB. Around in 2014. So we got to fours and we did our B, which was $1 million. And at that point, we'd raised 1.35. And it was still sort of it was more a seed round still. We called it Series B because it was just sequential rather than like, you know, true Series B. And then we ended up raising a Series C that brought in, it was through a convertible note and then sort of a placement. And that was around, I think, around 10 million. And that sort of fund, that got us to about mid-teens locations. And at that point, like when I would jump full-time, we were doing around like 13 million in revenue or 14 million. And I could see how there was a real pathway to get to 25 million. And all we needed to do was just execute really well, not take too many outside risks, but continue to operate really well in New York primarily, because the market capacity is so big. Starbucks have 300 locations in New York City. So I'm like, well, listen, clearly Bluestone could have 30, you know, so there's lots of runway here. There's 8 million people to service, and we're building this core competency. So, I did have a view that we were building this brand. We weren't just a coffee shop. We were a lifestyle brand. People talked about going to Bluestone to catch up with friends. They talked about going to Bluestone not to even drink the coffee, but to get an avocado toast or to get a grain bowl. And I could see how it was becoming part of people's daily rituals. It was manifesting into something bigger than just being a dispensary for food and drink. So I thought, wow, all the Australian coffee shops or cafe brands that had entered New York or London were doing really well. They were helping support this awareness, this global brand of like Aussie style or Aussie New Zealand style cafes. And you find that if you go to Hong Kong or Singapore or London, like people go, oh, it's, you know, it's an Aussie or it's a New Zealander. And immediately people go, great coffee. It's going to have avocado toast and it's probably going to have like great service and feeling. You know, it's not going to be homogenous. It's not going to be cookie cutter transactional. And I thought we could be the leader here. We could own this space. It's going to be huge. If Starbucks is, you know, now got 40,000 stores, 41,000 stores, like Starbucks got 41,000 stores, like surely we could have 100. And it was sort of back solving out of that and the probability of it working. So I jumped full time and we just started rolling, and we went to some new geographies. I thought if we could open in California and if it's successful and I could cover two coasts, which is an incredibly risky move, but if I can do it and build a brand, I'm going to answer a lot of questions about the scalability. Because if you just stay in New York, even though you could probably get great economics, there can always be this doubt on like, can you make money outside New York? And New York's brutally hard to make money, but if you catch fire and you're on, the thing can blow up overnight because of the density, because of the media, all of those, that all that amplification, the people that go there, their influence, it can just rocket ship you. And that's the advantage of starting a business in New York City. You get New York City brand, which is the world's biggest brand, bigger than Apple, bigger than Nike.
How have you guys survived, or how did you survive so far this pandemic? Has that been a really tough obstacle for the company?
Absolutely brutal, because our real estate footprint was so precariously positioned. We're an urban brand in the big city where the big COVID positive cases were originating. Nearly half our stores are in New York City, and New York City was the epicenter. And I'll never forget, I was flying out. I was in New York, over the West Coast when we really started scaling a couple of years ago, and in sort of 2018. And I was going to New York every second week and flying, work 4 days, come back. And I was there the week of March 10th. It was just the feeling was so uneasy. And I remember having a meeting with our major investor about what are we going to do if this really happens. And we had different phases. And we elected to implement phase one, which was slow down some of the spend, just monitor things, maybe trim hours, nothing like. And we had stage four, which was you're going to have to make some cuts, going to have to close stores and everything. I ended up leaving the city on March 13th because there was a rumor going around that they were going to close entry and exit to the city, and that there was 20,000 cases already. People were really starting to freak out. And I ended up going straight to the airport and flying home. I didn't want to be trapped if that was ever going to happen. And luckily, it obviously didn't. But I get to the airport and I couldn't believe everyone was wearing masks. I'm like, what is going on? This is crazy. And I end up flying home. But sure enough, that week, our sales fell 50%. And then the following week, our sales fell another 40%. So we're about 80% down. Actually, it was about 80% down from 2 weeks prior. And that was just unbelievable because we had all this fixed costs because of leases and people. Sure. And then you have no revenue. So we were bleeding money, hemorrhaging money from everywhere. And we just had to move so quickly and make some decisions because no one knew what it was, how bad it was. But we learned very quickly. We had lots of COVID in our team. My brother got COVID that week. He gave it to another member of our team who runs all our digital. And it was just everywhere. And it's just been tragic. But I'm so enormously proud of what we've achieved and our team. They have done the most incredible job to remain focused and galvanized. And more than anything, the courage they've shown to go to work. We paid for everyone's transport for a couple of months there, but it was so expensive because no one was driving. And a lot of our staff, well outside of the city, they ended up having to find their other own means there. And even getting the train to work every day, that was a bold move. And I'm forever grateful for what the sacrifices they made. They truly did to keep us going and continuity. And we're able to support the community. And one of the big things we did is we did a concept called Fuel for Heroes, where we provided free coffee for first responders and healthcare heroes. And we donated 50,000 coffees. And we delivered them over a couple of months period to 30 hospitals across 5 states. And we did it personally. The team did it. My brother kicked it off. And he went to Elmhurst Public that was ground zero. Met the team there. And it was really important for us. And I think it gave us some resolve and some focus outside of just the businesses in a really bad shape to, hey, we've got to be there for the community. That's what we pride ourselves on being, a really positive contributor. And this is the time to get behind it and show up. And we did, and we've made it through, which is very grateful to still.
Listen, I'm thankful. As I said, you guys are right across the street from where I live, and I saw the shop closed for several months, and I know New York real estate and rents, and I'm so happy to know that it was about survival, and I have no doubt you guys are going to continue to flourish now, because as we said, I think New York will be coming back. They now have the outdoor dining, and I've seen people sit outside in the warmer weather kind of towards the end of the summer and early fall at Bluestone Lane on 73rd, which was great to see. And in the little bit of time we have left, and you talk about Starbucks and market cap and how many stores they have, what is your goal? What are those next steps? And then what is your ultimate goal with Bluestone Lane?
I think for us, we're shooting towards 100 million revenue. You know, I think that's like the number, the quantitative target. But I think that the purpose of the brand has been more invigorated than ever because of COVID. And the reason why we exist is because we make people feel good. We are a brand that's centered around health and humanity, and nothing is going to change that. And I think ultimately, and you talked upon it earlier in this call, that people are spending so much time connected on their devices, and they're having a lot of connectivity, but they're not having a lot of human connection. And the pandemic has accelerated that. But pre the pandemic, people were already lonely. They were isolated. They're having these virtual relationships. They were missing that team camaraderie. They were missing that connection. And ultimately, that's Bluestone Lane's purpose, to bring people together and to really tackle some of these like big externalities linked to mental health and depression and isolation, and people being, you know, perpetually sad, and all of the extreme elements that it can go to. And that's what we want to pride ourselves on being. We want to be a place where you walk and you feel special and you feel recognized and you're part of our community. So I think the potential for us is endless, because I don't see smartphones and social media and the way that people connect virtually dissipating, but it needs to be augmented with human connection. We are social animals. We like being with other people. The pandemic showed us that in spades. That's why we're doubling down in New York, because once the vaccine gets to a certain level of herd and once the weather changes, I think you're going to see an explosion of people wanting to catch up with friends that they haven't seen for a year.
I agree with you 100%. And I already notice it within the last couple of weeks. I've had two people say, hey, let's go grab a coffee. Let's go, which is interesting, because literally a month ago, and not even a month ago, that wouldn't have happened. And as you said, what I love about what your brand stands for is connection. And I do agree that coming out of COVID and people being isolated, it was such a hard time. It was, for personally, I mean, it was just awful. I need that connection. I need that. I need to talk to people. I need to see people. I want to, and like, I just think you're absolutely right with how it looks like and how it's trending. And especially with a lot of your stores here in this city and now the sidewalk dining and cat, I just think hopefully it's going to be an explosion. And I will tell you now, I've got Bluestone Lane, I've got a Joe's, I've got a Starbucks, but I'll tell you, Nick, after this, I'm only going to Bluestone Lane. Unless I can get Schultz on my podcast from Starbucks, then he's my ultimate. But for right now, I'm going over there. And I love how you have the dog treats too, because I have my little guy on the ball, and you've definitely hit on something. And I think it's just that awesome experience you've brought from Australia here to New York. And again, about the human connection. So I want to thank you for coming on and talking about Bluestone Lane, and I wish you all the success in the world.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the opportunity. And yeah, I'm so proud of the team, and I'm excited. I actually think that the second half of this year is going to be a lot of fun. I think it's going to be back to the 2010, arrived in the big city and was ready.
Yeah, I don't know if your wife's going to let you start going out to clubs and stuff like that and doing all those things.
It's going to be like 2010 where I couldn't get into any. It's going to be the same thing. Exactly. You know, too old and too many gray hairs.
Yes. Like you said, the best days were when you were actually young, although you're still young, when you're young and you had some money. Like, that's the whole thing. You can be young in New York and it could be terrible. If you're young and you have at least a little money where you can go enjoy yourself, and that's the sweet spot, man. You need to stay there.
Yeah. Listen, I don't have a lot, but you just need enough so you can buy exactly. yourself a couple that's of beers. It. And it's amazing how you find your way.
Yeah. Well, I'll look forward to getting my Bluestone Lane tomorrow morning, man.
Thank you very much.
All right, Nick. Thanks again.
Yeah.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com. or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's R-O-B-E-R-T-T-U-C-H-M-A-N, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuckman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.